So ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this webinar we're going to be embarking on today, which is what is ALT? What is accelerated life testing? And it's for those of us who have heard of accelerated life testing and highly accelerated life testing, and you might not be aware of what the difference is. Hopefully, after today's discussion, you will be across what the key differences are, which are quite substantial. So when we're talking about accelerated life testing, there's a bit in the name itself. We are trying to accelerate testing where we, for example, are trying to observe failures and understand how likely it is for something to happen or how frequently something's going to happen without having to test for year after year after year. And when it comes to accelerated life testing and reliability stuff more broadly, remember that while it's important, it can be important to measure reliability, and when I say measure reliability, also analyze reliability, it's way more important to design something in, design reliability in to your product, process, or what have you. And the same applies with ALT. ALT is all about measuring, so the top bit of text here, but it doesn't mean that it's going to make anything more reliable. It's all about characterizing the extent to which something is reliable. And you only ever do accelerated life testing once you know what the dominant few failure mechanisms are. So you do it after you've made something reliable. Now, that said, there are a few variations on the theme. For example, if you're trying to compare two fundamentally similar components from two separate suppliers or vendors, then accelerated life testing can help you work out which one is going to last longer and hence might influence your purchasing decision. So accelerated life testing is all about measuring how reliable something is after it's been hopefully made reliable. You can only ever do it once you work out those vital few dominant failure mechanisms which will ruin the day of your system or product. And so when we are doing accelerated life testing, it cannot be done in isolation. You need to have this thing called the quality and reliability mindset, which helps you focus on what it is you're trying to achieve. I've seen too many organizations do accelerated life testing just so they can say we've done accelerated life testing without it informing a decision. And so hopefully today we're going to go through what accelerated life testing is and what it isn't, starting with my very trusty example, which is the smart lock. The smart lock is a sort of consistent thing I use a lot in my courses, webinars, and tutorials. And so the smart lock, before we even start designing our smart lock, we know it's going to have 17 components roughly, 16 of them will be different as we have two identical handles. And of course, the reliability of the smart lock is based on the reliability of each one of these components. And the idea is that, for example, we want to make this thing fundamentally more reliable. So we might look at some of the critical weak points of our smart lock, which in this case, anyone who's done anything in the field of consumer electronics, you know that having cables and wires just held to PCBs and motors like this with solder joints, you're just asking for trouble. And so the idea is you do for Mears and Holt, the highly accelerated life testing and otherwise just good design practices to make sure that we avoid these sorts of scenarios in our preliminary designs. We don't want to have just those thin, flimsy cables. We want to have strong cables. We want to have a thicker gauge wire where we're concerned about solder joints coming off. We want to have shorter wires to accumulate less momentum, wire clips to physically secure wires. We want to also have in the back of our mind, we're going to have visual inspection of solder joints as they come in from our suppliers. And perhaps if we're still concerned, surveillance automated microscopic optical inspection for our incoming motors. In some cases, we'll try and remove the solder joints entirely by having sockets and plugs, which also makes assembly easier. And this is a sort of down and dirty, simplistic design practices that a lot of us forget when we're trying to design something that's amazing and reliable. In this day of AI, where unless it's sophisticated, sleek, and amazing, it's not really cutting edge. No, when it comes to reliability, it's often the simplest things that cause some otherwise amazing products to come undone. And so once we've gone through these steps of making our smart lock robust and reliable, unless we do that, we don't even think about doing accelerated life testing. So going back to that point, you look at the concept of having those vital few weak points of our smart lock, and you might do something like a FMEA or a fault tree analysis to work out what the top 10 weak points of your system are. And yes, every system has weak points. Anyone who says, no, our system never fails, it's not, doesn't have any weak points, means they haven't looked truly, or truly looked, I should say, at how their system works slash doesn't work. And here we have these red circles, which indicate, from our perspective, the top 10 things that are going to keep us up at night from our preliminary design. So imagine right at the very, very early design stages of our smart lock, when we sit down in a room and we do things like FMEAs, HALTs, fault tree analyses, we say, you know what, these 10 things here represented by these red circles, the size of the circle represents the amount of stress in our minds. These are the things that we think are going to cause our thing to fail one day. And the idea is that using those FMEAs and selective highly accelerated life testing, we routinely knock down those vital few weak points, replace them with corrective actions. And you can see that eventually, once we've replaced enough red circles with green ticks or check marks, we stop. And the reason we stop is because we know what the remaining weak points are. The red circles represent what those that sorry, visualize that we still have those weak points. Every system has weak points, but now we're informed. We know what those weak points are. We can say to each other, well, our smart lock's reliable, but when it does fail 10 years from now, it'll most likely be due to ultraviolet delamination of polymer XYZ or whatever it is. That's an informed level of reliability confidence. Confidence is a measure of you, so not a measure of your system. But that said, we still might want to quantify some of the really key ones. So once we got to this point where we have a really good understanding of our system, and hopefully our system is now a reliable product, we can then move on to trying to quantify how those vital few remaining weak points will eventually fail. And that is what accelerated life testing is all about. So let's just say now we want to understand the percentage of smart locks that will fail in the warranty period. So we've designed something that's fundamentally reliable, and now we're trying to inform our business or the bean counters, how many of our things do we expect to fail during the warranty period so we can accrue or keep some money aside to cover those warranty costs. Excuse me. So what could we do? Well, the warranty period for our smart lock is at 2 years. It's a 2-year warranty period. Now, some textbooks suggest that unless you're doing something like testing, you're not analyzing warranty reliability. But let's look at this a little bit more broadly. We'll examine testing first. We know this is our smart lock. This is our 17 components, 16 different. Like I said, approach number one from those textbooks is to get 100 final prototypes, test for 2 years, and see how many will still be working at the end of that 2-year period. Of course, anyone who's existed in the real world will know that 2 years is way too long. Why is it too long? Well, imagine just spending all this time and money creating an amazing smart lock, only for it to you everyone to sit and wait for 2 years while they get tested. That means for 2 years you're not making money as a company, which is a lethal characteristic for a young startup. The competitors, by the same token, are now dominating because your amazing smart lock is not in the market. And once you've done 2 years worth of testing, well, it's too expensive to do anything about warranty reliability if it's not where it needs to be, because you've got a final prototype. It's done. If you realize that something is intrinsically wrong with your design and you have a very mature design, it's really expensive and really time consuming to do anything about it. And so we don't want to do that. That's just a farcical approach. And a lot of military organizations still love that approach. But nonetheless, let's just say we have designed a wonderful smart lock. And we know that after we've implemented all those wonderful corrective actions through our familiars and HOLTs and everything else, we have these vital few residual weak points. These are the things that when our engineers are asked, when the smart lock fails, how will it fail eventually? And you can see these red circles represent the answers that each engineer or each team would give you. And that's okay. There always has to be answers. You can never say there won't be answers. So let's look at one of these troublesome points of our smart lock. And that troublesome point is our keypad. For whatever reason, some of our design teams are just concerned about the longevity of the keypad for our smart lock. And most smart lock keypads, not all, but most have a silicone molded keypad component beneath the faceplate where you press the key to create to close a circuit or complete a circuit behind the keys to allow the smart lock to know if you're pressing a 1, a 5, an 8, 7, or whatever button you're pressing. Now, we want to understand again the warranty reliability. How many smart locks will fail? Do we expect to fail during our 2-year warranty period? And again, we don't expect a lot. If you're having any more than 5 to 10% of your products failing during warranty period, you are not making money. So we still expect it to be a small fraction of the overall keypads and smart locks failing. It's just that even a small fraction can be financially crippling. So how do we understand how long this thing will last for 2 years? And so one approach is to try and mimic 2 years' worth of use without actually having to expose our keypad in particular to 2 years of actual use. How do we mimic those 2 years of use, ideally in a way where we don't have to expend that amount of time to get the same results? So let's just say we were able to create a use case where we anticipate that each key on the keypad will be, on average, pressed by one human finger twice a week. So we expect, on average, each key to experience two presses a week, 52 weeks in a year, so 104 presses in a year. And of course, 2-year warranty period, so 208 presses during our 2-year warranty period, which seems like a really low number, and it is. And that's because smart locks, we understand how the use case for smart locks, as a rule, most smart locks are being used, being unlocked remotely with Bluetooth connections and everything else. Keypads are almost seen as a backup mode of entry or backup method of entry or method of entry for infrequent users like cleaning staff, people who don't have the ability to remotely unlock smart locks. So the use case has to be informed, and we believe that on average, each key will be pressed twice a week. And so, how do we mimic 2 years' worth of actual use? Well, we could create a a finger pressing test rig. This is it here, where you have a cylinder representing a single human finger. We can push that up against the keypad, and we can control our keypad testing rig to mimic the pressing of a keypad. But now we can do this, simulate finger pressing much, much faster. We're not doing it twice a week. You can see how fast this is happening. But you need to be very careful when you're creating this test rig. Is the pressure right? Remember that when we press keys, human beings, that is, we rarely come at the key with a beautifully perpendicular force. We often sort of have this wiping motion where we sort of wipe down on our key when we're pressing it. And so we need to make sure that our keypad testing rig is either mimicking that or those human stresses aren't causing any additional failures. Do the natural oils in our fingertip make a difference, good or bad? Does a keypad need time to reset between presses? Silicone is is a very flexible solid, and sometimes flexible solids, they just need some time to sort of recuperate once they're returned to their resting position, so to speak. And so we need to make sure we're on top of these questions and have informed answers, and the informed answers then inform our keypad testing ring. But let's just say we have answers for all those questions and we're comfortable that the keypad testing rig is doing a pretty good job of simulating finger presses. So now we have the ability to test a lot more quickly. Now we're getting into the realm of accelerated live testing. And accelerated live testing is all about trying to replicate lots of use in a very short period of time. Now, the next thing I'm going to say might seem a little bit confusing, because now I'm going to say accelerated live testing is all about creating a straight line. Why is it all about creating a straight line? Well, let's go back to our keypad and we'll see why. So here is a typical chart that we use when it comes to accelerated live testing. On the vertical axis, we have some sort of characteristic life measure. In this case, years. On the horizontal axis, we have something analogous to stress. In this case, presses per week. And so if we have a look at two presses per week, or we try and plot the use case predicted stress of two presses per week, you can see that that's that red dot on the axis right there, very, very close to zero, two presses per week. Now, when we're doing accelerated life testing, we are increasing the stresses to, for example, in this case, maybe 100, 150, 200 presses per week. And these blue dots represent failure data from three accelerated life tests for our keypad. And you can see that, okay, 100, it took not very long to, obviously took some time to fail. When we're pressing the keypad faster than 100 times per week, 150 failed even quicker, 200 failed even quicker again. And you can see that if these three dots, they don't create a beautifully straight line, they create a curved line. This is not what we want in the field of accelerated life testing. The reason why is because straight lines can be projected with confidence to whatever use scenario you have. And when I say with confidence, with some confidence, there's some caveats we need to apply, but it's very, very hard to project curved lines with confidence back to our use case, which is, remember, two presses per week. So how do we create this straight line? Well, when we're creating charts like these accelerated live charts, we need to get the scaling right. You can see that we've changed the scale on the vertical axis. It seems a lot more compressed at the top, and a lot less compressed at the bottom. And that's because we now have an inverse negative scale for our characteristic life. And when we have this inverse negative scale for our characteristic life, our accelerated life tests start creating a straight line, which projects allows us to project back to two presses per week, which is our operational use. And you can see that based on this projection, it does indeed look like our keypads will last 2 years. Now, why are we trying to how do we create this straight line in this case? Well, it's all about understanding how damage accumulates. And that's a very key takeaway. Accelerated life testing only works on failure mechanisms where damage accumulates. And we can very comfortably assume that if we're looking at failure mechanisms associated with the number of key presses on our keypad, it is quintessentially all about the accumulation of damage. And it just so happens, if you do the math, you do the science, the negative inverse scale creates straight lines on these accelerated life charts for failure mechanisms where damage accumulates linearly. And so now we have our ability to test at a much higher rate of stress, project back to our normal use case, and make a useful deduction. Now, in this case, the test itself was based on no more than 0.04 years or 15 days of accelerated life testing. So 100 presses per week, We simulated 2 years' worth of use in 15 days. In 150 presses per week, we simulated 2 years' worth of use in about 10 days. In for 200 presses per week, it went down to about 7.5 days. So the higher the stress, the faster damage accumulates, which means we don't have to do 2 years' worth of testing to understand how likely it is for our keypad to fail. Now, essentially, in this case, all it means, but this scale, this really weird scale, every single this straight line represents the same amount of damage accumulated by 208 finger presses. So it's all about the accumulation of damage. You can see that our keypad is performing very consistently in this regard. It seems to fail at or around 208 finger presses, regardless of the stress we're applying to it. And this is a very key part of accelerated life testing. You can't just go to a book, get a model, and just hope the model is right. You need to do things like test it a minimum 3 points of higher stresses to confirm that you have this straight line. That means that you understand the failure mechanism, and that means you can project with confidence. You can't just assume there's a straight line, especially by testing at one higher stress level. So that's an example. Now, just to be clear, I would not be launching my product if I expect my keypad to fail after about 208 finger presses. That was just a numerical example. That test shows to me that we expect virtually every keypad to fail at or around 2 years worth of operational use. It would be a disaster for our organization. So that is clearly too short a period, I should say, our keypad's not robust enough. But hopefully you get the point. Instead of 208 finger presses, hopefully you do your accelerated life testing, your keypad, and to be in the thousands and be all good. Now, but you also might notice that keypad pressing example was rather simple. It was all about just having a simple finger pressing rig to essentially do things faster. But things are not always that simple. So for example, a lot of failure mechanisms are based on chemical reactions. Oxidation, corrosion, dendritic growth. So many things are based on how chemicals react with each other and change. And so one of the most useful realms for accelerated life testing is when we have failure based on chemical reactions. Now, chemical reaction is when things called reactants do stuff to turn into products. Now, as a rule, what that means is that the chemicals on the left, the reactants, are at a higher energy level, which is usually the case. When you manufacture something and when you push atoms in together and when you combine things in unique ways, you often are imparting a lot of energy to modify the chemical structure or the molecular structure of materials. Now, you might have noticed that we don't go around planet Earth tripping over stainless steel rocks, for example. We have to make stainless steel. It doesn't exist naturally. So a lot of energy goes into materials like stainless steel, like polymers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they are always wanting to go back to lower energy states, which we call products. But there are some barriers to that transition from a reactant to a product. And we know that these chemical reactions or all these chemicals want to do this because they release energy when that happens. So a very well-known chemical reaction, I think I mentioned it, is corrosion. So you have the beautiful, pristine bolt on the left, and eventually it'll rust and turn into the bolt on the right. Now, even then, corrosion is not necessarily the death knell of a product. There are plenty of things, plenty of components on cars, on machines, which are corroding away, but structurally still very sound. But there are also plenty of scenarios where corrosion can really ruin your day. So let's look at corrosion in some greater detail. Sorry, I can see that I see a couple of questions coming through. To confirm, yes, one asks, for ALT, the testing is done at nominal design specifications/limits. I'll come back to that one We'll see what we're talking about with accelerated life testing when it, maybe hopefully this discussion on corrosion will help us understand the answer to that question. So let's zoom into the atomic structure of our steel that as it comes from the hardware store. Now, the atoms in our steel, which are mainly made up of iron, but quite a few other elements in there as well to try and control the properties. But you can see we have a largely iron lattice structure on the left-hand side. And you can see we put a lot of effort into manufacturing our steel bolt. And so these atoms are perfectly aligned in this crystalline form. Now, of course, this is not what it looks like for real. If it was absolute zero, i.e., if our bolt was very, very cold, this is what our atoms would look like. But in the real world, even really cold temperatures still involve some sort of thermal energy. So even when we turn the temperature up ever so slightly, our atoms are sitting there vibrating away because they have energy. This is temperature. So they're sitting in their lattice, but they're vibrating away, storing that kinetic energy that temperature is. And of course, as you can imagine, when you have these atoms vibrating away in this lattice structure, it does put some stress on the bonds that hold these atoms together. And so you can imagine straight away that the hotter these things become, the more energy that these atoms get, the harder it is to stay in a well-ordered structure like this. We call that melting. So if we have so much energy in our atoms that they overcome the bonds holding them in this lovely solid structure, the bolt melts. But let's assume, for very valid reasons, that our bolt's not going to melt just yet. Let's just say we have some sort of temperature applied to the bolt, as there's virtually no place in space or the universe which genuinely has a temperature of absolute zero. And so here are our atoms vibrating away with some residual temperature making that happen. Now, also, we know that most bolts in the real world are exposed to atmospheres and the things in those atmospheres. So we know that our bolt will be exposed to water and oxygen, plus a lot of other things. You can see how I have our H2O molecule on the right, on the top, and our oxygen molecule at the bottom. And so while our atoms are vibrating away, they are always being bombarded with H2O molecules and oxygen molecules. And as a rule, most of these molecules just bounce off harmlessly. And you can see that now we have a sort of maybe a little bit of warfare going on. We want the atoms to stay in that lattice structure we created to make sure that our bolt retains its strength. But you can see essentially there's a lot going on here at the atomic level. Now, eventually, one of these molecules, in the presence of water and oxygen, will have enough kinetic energy to essentially knock one of these iron atoms out of place and replace it with an oxygen atom. You can see it right there. It's a little teeny tiny deformation or defect. We call that rust or corrosion. The chemical that we are now starting to create is iron three oxide, which is this combination of, on average, two iron atoms with three oxygen atoms. And you can see we only have one oxygen atom here so far, but we're starting to create this ratio of for every two iron atoms getting three oxygen atoms. Now, this is okay. This is going to happen no matter what. But you can see that as a rule, the molecules hitting the surface of the iron, just they're not hitting very hard. They just don't have a lot of energy. If we change the scenario by increasing the energy, by increasing the temperature, then bad things start to happen. All of a sudden, the iron atoms are not as easily held in place, and they have oxygen and hydrogen atoms hitting the iron so fast that it very quickly allows the more lower energy iron oxide, iron three oxide, to occur. And now, with the temperature up, the rate at which this reaction happens increases. And now we have rust everywhere. And you can just see how much more violently the atoms are vibrating at this scale. And so what you were seeing in a very real way is the effect that temperature has on a chemical reaction. Every chemical reaction is triggered by the kinetic energy stored in the atoms and molecules. The more kinetic energy that these atoms and molecules have, the more likely it is for that chemical reaction to occur. So if you want chemical reactions to slow down, you cool things down. If you want chemical reactions to speed up, you heat everything up. And corrosion in particular will occur much faster if the temperature is higher. So hopefully you can see in a very real way how we can accelerate something like a chemical reaction occurring. So hopefully that little preamble makes sense. Now, like I said, not all failure mechanisms are based on the number of presses. Lots are based on things like chemical reactions. Now, while that is a bit of a bummer that increasing the temperature makes things wear out faster, so to speak, we can exploit that characteristic to create those straight lines on the accelerated life chart. So we can create an accelerated life chart for virtually every chemical reaction in order to do accelerated testing. So, for example, let's go back one step for our SmartLock. We're trying to work out which sort of rubber we should use for our keypad to try and extend the life of the SmartLock overall. Remember, accelerated life testing is there to quantify stuff. If you have material from two suppliers and you want to compare them, which one's more reliable, then accelerated life testing can be a really, really awesome way of doing that if you know how those things will chemically degrade. And so for our keypad, let's just say we have a choice of two different types of silicone rubbers. Maybe we have peroxide cured rubbers or sulfur cured rubbers. And let's just say this is our first SmartLock. We don't know which one's better. I'm sure you should do some research, and I'm pretty certain even a Google search will help you answer this question if you wanted to do it while watching this webinar. But that's not the point. Let's just say that you come across a scenario where you have two different materials and you want to know which one is going to chemically degrade the slowest, i.e., lasts the longest. What can you do? Well, accelerated life testing can get you there. Now, you see, we now have this accelerated life chart, which looks very similar, I suppose, to the one for the key presses. On the horizontal axis, instead of key presses per week, it's temperature. As you can see, 20 degrees Celsius, 40 degrees Celsius, 60 degrees Celsius, so on and so forth. But you should also notice that there is something weird going on with the scale. You can see as we move from left to right, the steps, those 20 degrees Celsius steps, are getting closer and closer. And the vertical axis, we have this characteristic life in hours, and it's going up logarithmically. Every red line is an increase by a factor of 10. So 1, 10, 100. Next red line, which is not labeled, is 1,000, then 10,000, 100,000, a million, so on and so forth. So we have this chart which has this weird scale, but this is the chart that we use for chemical reactions. And I'll explain why very shortly. So the idea is that if you want to increase the rate at which chemicals degrade, you turn the temperature up. And so for our rubbers, for our different types of rubbers we're going to use for our keypads, we can increase the temperature to what is conceivably very, very high. So let's turn it all the way up to 160 degrees Celsius, and we test peroxide cured rubber to see how long it takes for it to degrade to the extent that our keypad would essentially fail. And we have these three data points, and lo and behold, they create a straight line, which tells us straight away that if we see a straight line on this particular chart, a chemical reaction is causing this thing to fail. And we can draw a straight line back to the lower temperatures, which is where this keypad will be used 9 times out of 10. Now we can compare the test data we get for sulfur cured rubber at these elevated temperatures, and it too creates a straight line. And so if we look at a temperature of 40 degrees Celsius, let's just say 40 degrees Celsius, still quite warm, but that's closer to the operational conditions of our smart locks keypad. We draw a line straight up. You can see that the peroxide cured rubber, it has an estimated 1600 year life at 40 degrees Celsius. The sulfur cured rubber has an estimated 170 year life, also at 40 degrees Celsius. Now, you can see that we have some informed estimates on as regarding how long these rubbers will last. But the test data itself, those data points, they did not take a lot of time to compile. In this case, I think it was no more than 6 weeks. The longest test duration on this chart was about 6 weeks worth of testing. Now, some of you might say, okay, so 1600 year life versus 170 year life. So they're both going to last a very, very long time. So this test proves nothing. Well, yes and no. It does tell us that both rubber materials seem to be able to do what we need them to do. Remember, we want our keypad to last 2 to 10 years, perhaps. And this 170 years versus the 1600 years seems like overkill. And yes, to an extent, it is. However, let's just say that the cost of these rubbers are similar. That is, there's no difference in terms of how much the smart lock will cost if we choose sulfur cured rubber versus peroxide cured rubber. Well, if that's the case, then you'd be crazy to not go with the one which has the 1600 year life predicted at 40 degrees Celsius, because there are so many different things out there which can accelerate chemical reactions in ways that we can struggle to predict. For example, let's just say have a smart lock in my home state in Australia, a place called Queensland. We're near the beaches. Well, I can guarantee you that smart locks near the places like the Sunshine Coast, when people come home from the beach, they will have sunscreen on their fingers every single day. In where I come from, you put sunscreen on kids just to go to school. And so you might have, in that particular geographic location in Australia, smart locks where the keypads are covered in sunscreen. And things like sunscreens contain solvents and abrasives, which can accelerate chemical reactions. And so by simply choosing the more robust of the two materials, if they have similar price points, you might have just saved yourself an entire recall for an entire country or geographical area just by choosing the more apparently more reliable of the two. Because 1600 years is great if you're exposing your keypad silicone to higher temperatures only. But once you have solvents and sunscreens, you'd be surprised how fast that can accelerate chemical reactions. And so the rubber, which has the 170-year life, that might actually be disastrously unreliable when we have those additional chemicals thrown into the mix. But now we're starting to make informed decisions, which is what accelerated life testing is all about, trying to help us make informed decisions. So be aware, though, that these are point estimates. You can see they're just best guesses. Now, we are often needing to have way more than just best guesses. So 1600 years, okay, it's a point estimate. 170 years, that's also a point estimate. We often need to do way more than have point estimates. We often need to incorporate confidence into our data points. We can't just say 170 years is our best guess. In some cases, we need to do things like understand the L5 life. L5 life is the time by which we expect 5% of our things to have failed. And it can be a useful way of contrasting how long it will take for those early failures to occur versus how long it will take for most things to fail. And often the L5 life is way more important to us when we have warranty reliability targets of 95% or more. So we can still have that in our accelerated life testing regime. So let's just say that even though the peroxide cured rubber seems to be way more reliable, and it is, let's also say that for whatever reason, we're just about to launch, now supplier ran out of peroxide cured rubber. That's a bummer. Okay, so all right, so we have this. Only have sulfur cured rubber left to choose from. All right, so that's it. We have to have a keypad with sulfur cured rubber for whatever reason. 170-year life, best guess. But when's the first 5% of these things going to fail? Well, accelerated life testing can still help us out because we can just test more products at those higher stresses. You can see those data points on the right-hand side. Now we have five different rubbers tested at 100, I think it's, I'm trying to remember. I think it's about 100 degrees, 125 and 145 degrees Celsius. We have three different test regimes, higher temperatures, and we test these rubbers until failure. And now we have five data points for each temperature value. And because the rate of degradation is constant, this is a little trick you can use in accelerated life testing. Whenever you're able to create that straight line in a chart, well, the normal distribution or the bell curve can be used to model those times to failure in this chart with these weird scales. And so we can use a couple little statistical tricks and tests to essentially put a bell curve over the spread of these data points we have at these higher temperatures, which means we don't just project a straight line back, we're able to project an entire bell curve back to an operating temperature of 40 degrees Celsius. So now we don't just have a best guess, we also have a spread on that best guess. And if we zoom in, we can see if this bell curve we got from our accelerated life testing, we can look at the area under that curve and work out where the bottom 5% of the area exists. And now we're able to work out or predict when the first 5% of all keypad failures will occur at 40 degrees Celsius, simply by looking at this bell curve projected back in temperature, so to speak. And so from this chart, we expect there to be a 43.11 year L5 life at 40 degrees Celsius. Now, hopefully you'll notice that 43 years is a long way from 170 years, which is a very, very interesting, very important point. When we have logarithmic scales, sometimes the best guess is still a best guess, but those annoying 5% of early failures can be very, very fast compared to your 170-year best guess. And so 43 years is still plenty long enough for our smart lock to last through its warranty period. I'd be comfortable using sulfur-cured rubber given this accelerated life testing. But it also just shows the importance of making sure we don't just rely on best guesses. You need to understand what metrics matter. You need to understand the confidence and spread in these random variables. And the L5 life here has given me a lot more confidence that we can use sulfur-cured rubber for our keypad and not have to worry too much about chemical degradation. Notwithstanding all those concerns I had about sunscreen and abrasives and all the other things that we sometimes are surprised that human beings throw on our systems when they use them in the way that they seem fit. So now we're starting to have a lot more information about our silicone keypad or our rubber keypad for our smart lock. And so accelerated life testing is all about creating these straight lines. But how do we create these straight lined accelerated life charts? I've just said, here's a chart which creates straight lines for finger presses. And here's another chart which creates straight lines for chemical reactions. Well, this is the only bit where we're going to look at a couple of equations, just for the nerds and the geeks out there, because it's worth knowing at least where this thing comes from for chemical reactions. Now, for chemical reactions in particular, every time you do accelerated life testing, you need to understand the failure mechanism at play. So a reactant, like I said, usually exists, not usually, always exists at a high energy level. We put a lot of effort into creating this substance, and usually that's ordered in a way where that's the atoms are just dying to get back to their less ordered state. And that's because they have the products exist at a lower energy level. So you can see the difference between the two energy levels at the for the different material structures. You can also see there is a hump or hill between those two states. That hump, the distance above the resting energy of our reactants, is called the activation energy. That's the energy that our atoms need to get over that hump and then go down the hill towards that product state. That's where the temperature comes into play, that kinetic energy, that vibration from those molecules and atoms comes into play to slowly but surely, one by one, look at those atoms in the reactants, give them enough energy to get over the hill, and then turn into products, releasing energy when they do. And so that's how our bolt goes from beautifully pristine bolt on the left to corroded bolt on the right. And yes, corrosion does release heat. It's just that the reaction is so slow, the heat tends to not be noticeable, but it certainly creates heat. Now, there is a very smart dude who came up with a way of modeling this scenario. This is called the Arrhenius model. And here is a god-awful equation here. Now, he worked out that if we use the letter K to represent the rate of a reaction, how fast things happened, he was able to work out that if we knew the activation energy of our chemical reaction and the temperature in degrees Kelvin, multiply this with another K. Yes, we have two Ks. In this case, that's the Boltzmann's constant, which has that horrific sequence of digits down there in terms of joules per Kelvin. We have some constant which is unique to each reaction, and we have Euler's number, and we can actually replace the rate of reaction with this fraction over here, which is another constant, and L, the characteristic life. Why am I torturing you with this equation? Well, what we can do is massage this equation like this is step number one, and step number two to create this one here. This is just the Arrhenius model rearranged with natural logarithms and fractions, and you name it. And you might not be able to appreciate it just yet, but actually, this equation gives us a straight line if we have those scales. Remember, the vertical scale on that chart I showed you was a logarithmic scale. And you can see we have the logarithm of the characteristic life on the left-hand side, and the jumble of symbols and everything else on the right is essentially giving us the scale, this negative inverse scale for the horizontal axis for temperature in degrees Kelvin. And so the Arrhenius plot is anything based on this chart here where those scales come from that equation. And it just so happens that if we have the characteristic life in the logarithmic scale and the negative inverse temperature on the horizontal scale, I should say, in degrees Kelvin, but we can convert that to degrees Celsius or degrees Fahrenheit, we get this chart here where if you have any chemical reaction, it will create this straight line that you can project back to real world or use case scenarios. And so this is just one of many ways of doing accelerated life testing to essentially speed up how fast your things fail. So one thing I want to make very clear about the Arrhenius model is that the chart essentially means you don't have to worry about those equations or finding about activation energies or anything else. As long as it's a chemical reaction, you create your own straight line, which you can project back with a ruler to your operating conditions. So you don't need to find those constants. The Arrhenius model is embedded in those scales in that chart. And that means you can turn the temperature up for any chemical reaction to speed up how quickly it happens. And so that is a brief introduction into accelerated life testing. You have to understand your failure mechanism well enough for have an equation like this, or have some smart dude in the past come up with this equation, and just understand, okay, chemical reactions, this equation here has been used to create a chart where if I put the test data in, I get that straight line, and I'm able to work out how long things will last. But remember, measuring reliability can be important, which is what accelerated life testing is, but it's not nearly as important as making or improving reliability. So you only do accelerated life testing once you have something to test. You can't test your way to reliability. You have to work out what are the key failure mechanisms of your device. And of those key failure mechanisms, work out which ones you can accelerate if you want to indeed test to see how long they will last. So, oh, some reason decided to cut me out. Give me one second. I'll be back in a minute, hopefully. Bear with me. This is a user error. Can't blame my computer for this one. Almost there. I'm back. All right, so that's accelerated life testing in a nutshell. It's different to highly accelerated life testing in that essentially I've got webinars on HALT. You're trying to break your device to see where the weak points are. HALT is even faster. You try to find the weak points by exposing them to extraordinary stresses, but done in a very scientific way. So you're trying to rapidly find the weak points of your components in order to improve the design. Accelerated life testing is not so much about informing the design per se itself. Yes, it can inform which components you use or which sort of rubber you use, but you're going to use it once you've worked out what the dominant failure mechanisms for your system or components are to characterize how long they will last. And so you should only do that once you have a really good idea of what those weak points are, after you've designed everything out of your system, and then you can start moving forward with confidence. Okay, so I can see a few comments and questions coming my way. Let's see. So I'll go back to that question. Is it Yeshwanth asks? Accelerated life testing is all about design specs stuff. No, it's not. By definition, you're trying to increase, expose your things to temperatures that, well, temperature's one stress. You're trying to increase stresses beyond normal design specs, use cases to accelerate those failures, to make them occur faster. So, in chemical reactions, one way of doing that is to increase the temperatures beyond those that your device would expect to see in real life. One huge caveat, though, you need to, if you're going to do something like increase temperature or increase voltage or increase current or increase whatever stress it is, for fatigue, you might want to increase the cyclic stresses. You need to do it in a way where you don't change how the failure mechanism behaves. So, for example, if you were to increase the temperature that our rubbers were exposed to a very high temperature, the rubber would probably just melt. That doesn't prove anything, doesn't test anything. It's failing in a completely different and unique way that you would never experience in the real world. Same with steels and alloys in particular. For those of you who have ever heard of the word eutectic, that you know that the way atoms are arranged in an alloy is very, very conditional on temperature. So we know that when you're welding or things like that, you have heat-affected zones, and that's very important to understand that because whenever you increase temperature on steels, you risk the structure of those atoms changing to something which is weaker or more brittle. And so you want to make sure that those stresses, the temperatures, the voltages, the currents, the cyclic stresses, the number of cycles, so on and so forth, don't fundamentally change the mechanism. It doesn't matter if it melts. That just means you've turned up the temperature too far. So hopefully that answers your question, Yeshwanth, and your question or comment, Kenneth. Now, Kenneth also mentioned salt. So what is salt? Salt is something which can accelerate things like corrosion, where you have sodium chloride. It's a catalyst. What is a catalyst? A catalyst is a secondary chemical, which means that which gives your reactants an alternate pathway to become a product. So remember that activation energy at the top of that hill, and you go down to the product, the bottom of the hill. When you have a catalyst, essentially all that does, it creates a different pathway which goes around that activation energy hill, which means you need a lot less energy to have that chemical reaction occur. And sodium chloride or salt is one way of reducing the activation energy for iron turning into rust. And so salts can accelerate chemical reactions as well. Problem with salt is it can be challenging to work out or model the extent to which salt increases the rate of that chemical reaction. So while we can change the temperature and understand the temperature of our iron very carefully, for 100 degrees Celsius, 200 degrees Celsius, 300 degrees Celsius, what have you, salt is, in a way, it's either there or it's not. Now, there are some really sophisticated tests out there where the salt content is very tightly controlled and understood. But yes, adding salt, in a way, can inform the rate at which your chemical reactions accelerate. And it goes back to my point I was making about the keypad and the solvents and the sunscreens and everything else. There's always chemicals which can really ruin your day. For the bolt slash rust ALT, what is the failure mode? If it is snapping under load, do you first apply a preload before raising the temperature? Now, I must admit that the bolt itself perhaps is not the best example of something failing. Rusty bolts still do a pretty good job. You look at the chassis of your vehicle, that chassis is rusting all the time. It's just the rust is so slow, it's at the surface level, that it's not going to cause your vehicle to fall apart anytime soon. However, corrosion can be a very big deal for example, oil pipelines. So you'll have protective coats on oil pipelines. And the idea is that those protective coating then prevents oxygen getting to the steel in the oil pipeline, oil and gas pipeline. But whenever that coating is scratched, essentially it's just a matter of time before corrosion works its way through. So for the oil pipeline itself, a very common failure mode is corrosion creating essentially a rupture or a leak or a hole in the pipe itself. Now, for bolts, as a rule, the amount of stresses and loads the bolt is experiencing, the rate at which corrosion occurs would, for most bolts, especially in domestic applications, would take forever, not forever, but a very long time, that bolt to essentially fail. But hopefully that answers your question. I just use the bolt as an example here because it's more visually relevant to many scenarios. Hopefully that answers your question, Johan. Yeshwanth asks again, can ALT be used at a system level testing? Additionally, what would be the sampling recommendations for ALT? So the answer is yes, ALT can be used at system level testing, but it always focuses on a failure mechanism. So you can't just put a microwave or a car or a laptop or a transducer or a gear shaft into an oven, turn up the temperature and see how long it lasts without knowing how it's going to fail. So failure mechanisms are the target of accelerated life testing. They are all about accelerated life testing is about increasing the rate at which something fails. So it's all about understanding whether it's corrosion, dendritic growth, creep, fatigue, so on and so forth. And so, yes, the answer to your question is yes, you can test at a system level as long as you're accelerating a particular failure mechanism. Now, why is it a qualified yes? Because most times, if you know the failure mechanism you're trying to accelerate, it's usually much easier to test a component. So one way, think about the fuselage of an aircraft, which is aluminum slash aluminium. We know that aluminum fatigue is different to steel alloy, iron alloy fatigue. And so you can essentially replicate the takeoff landing cycles for fuselage panels on an aircraft if you want to. And yes, you can do that. And they have done it in the past where they pressurize a fuselage and depressurize a fuselage over and over and over again to simulate fatigue cracking on our aluminum panels. That was done in the 1950s when we started learning about how fatigue was essentially behind many at that point in time, unexplained aircraft crashes. But these days, it's much easier to replicate that accelerated life testing on the panel itself. if you know the stresses it's going to experience. So the answer is yes, you can do it at system level if you want to. It's often more expensive. It often means you have to do it later in the design process because you need to have the whole system. And it's usually much easier, not always, but usually much easier to do it at the component level earlier in the design process if you understand the failure mechanism and the stresses the thing's going to experience. And finite element analysis can be very helpful for that. Stephen asks, your slide that showed the normal distributions on the transformed scales life versus stress seems to assume the failure time distribution is log normal. Do you typically assume this or consider other probability distributions at a given stress level, such as Weibull? Great question, Steve. So in the real world, what that means is that that bell curve that you saw, let me get back to said slide. This one. So the bell curve that we see in this chart, actually, when you see that it actually applies across the logarithmic scale on the vertical axis, and I do have webinars of the log normal distribution, it would then morph to, well, not morph, it actually is a log normal distribution. Time to failure is log normally distributed in this scenario. So, Stephen, the reason why we see the bell curve in the accelerated life chart itself, where we have those straight lines, is due to the central limit theorem. What these straight lines do is mathematically transform the damage which is being accumulated to a linear or proportional model, i.e., straight line. And when we have damage being accumulated linearly or proportionally, we get the bell curve, which is why times to failure for rubber tires have that bell curve, because the amount of tread you lose is proportional to every mile or kilometer you drive. So in this case, when you're able to replicate that straight line accumulation of damage, statistically speaking, you would expect to see the bell curve describe the distribution of those data points in this scale. So depending on what failure mechanism it is, you'll have a different scale on the vertical axis, which means the bell curve will then morph to a log normal or perhaps a Weibull or what have you in different scenarios. Now, the other thing too, because we are only modeling things that wear out, i.e. accumulate damage, then if it is going to be a Weibull distribution, it will be one which will obviously have a shape parameter that is greater than one. So it's a statistical, not anomaly, but it's a statistical characteristic that we can really exploit. You will tend to see the bell curve model the distribution in times to failure when those data points are plotted within the scale of the accelerated life chart that creates a straight line. Does that answer your question, Steve? And what comes back to that central limit theorem? Actually, I'll open that question to anyone. I think, Steve, anyone else whose question I attempted to answer, did I come close to doing what I needed to do? Yeah, Steve, that bell curve thing, it's actually really useful. It's as whenever you have a straight line, the damage is being mathematically constrained to accumulate linearly. By definition, the central limit theorem is describing what's going on. Thanks, Kevin. Okay, D'Angelo asks, great value-added discussion. I'm struggling with the balance between practicality and accelerating the failure mechanisms. Would it be violation of best practice for ALT if the failure mechanism is accelerated by applying stress in a way that is not practical? Okay, I'm not entirely sure what you mean by not practical. So I think you're referring to stress being applied in a way that it would not be applied in normal operational use. Is that what you're saying? Okay. So in this case, for example, we can see that we're on the screen right now, we can have temperatures are up to 150 degrees Celsius, which you would not expect your smart lock keypads ever be exposed to. But that's the point. If you want to constrain your stresses to use case, then you need to wait 240, 170 years, 1600 years to get the test data to estimate time to failure. If you understand the failure mechanism and you know that in adding the so-called impractical stresses won't fundamentally change that failure mechanism, then you can feasibly increase that stress to whatever you want. And lots of organizations do. You look at, for example, even aircraft. We just talked about aircraft. They do exactly what I talked about, where they expose different parts of the fuselage to impractical stresses by your definition to understand the service life, the number of takeoff landing cycles they can reasonably expect to get from their aircraft before they fail. So there's no problem by having these impractical stresses, like temperatures that exceed 100 degrees Celsius, as an example, if you can confirm that they don't change the fundamental underlying failure mechanism. Now, that might sound intimidating, but in a way, it's not. You could confirm that you haven't changed the chemical reaction if you see the straight line in this chart. If you see a curved line in an Arrhenius plot, that means the chemical reaction is changing. It might mean that by increasing the temperature, you're actually changing that molecular substructure. So the rubber or the steel alloy is no longer the rubber/steel alloy that you're going to see in real life. So you want, if you don't feel comfortable increasing the stresses beyond what you deem to be practical, then essentially you just go back to testing your product in real world scenarios. If you're trying to demonstrate a 10-year service life, well, you need to wait 10 years. That's what it means. And so that's what accelerated life testing is all about. Not having to wait 10 years or 2 years or 1600 years or 170 years to understand how long it's going to take for your thing to fail. No worries. Did that answer your question, D'Angelo? No worries, man. Any more questions? Not a problem. Thank you for throwing that question my way. When people ask questions, it makes the webinars better, because usually those questions are focused on points that I didn't explain very well. Thank you, Kenneth. Any more? Thanks, Chris. Cool name. The corrosion simulation. Yeah, the reason I use corrosion is because everyone knows it. And it's pretty much exactly what happens. Like, one of the lessons I learned is that I might, after have the bolts, I might might have an oil and gas pipeline to make it very, very hopefully in your face relevant. The number of times that's happened where oil and gas pipelines have been scratched due to people digging or work crews inadvertently hitting the side of a pipeline, and 10, 15 years later, you have an explosion. It happens all the time. D'Angelo writes, it is assumed when designing your alt plan that you will stay within the operational limits, destructive limits found in HALT testing. Will this be an accurate assumption? Yes and no, because when it comes to HALT, destruct limits, absolutely. I mean, but then again, the destruct limits are the limits for the weakest part of your system. So if you're... Let's think of something. Let's just say your system has a nylon bush. Nylon melts at a relatively low temperature compared to where some other temperatures are. And you do HALT testing, and of course your destruct limit is where might be where your nylon bush melts. Well, there might be components, metallic alloys, where of course they're not going to melt. So your system has been destroyed when the nylon bush melts. You can't come back from that. But there's still components which are very happy, so to speak. There's nothing wrong if you're trying to accelerate a failure mechanism on one of those steel alloy components, to increase the temperature when you're looking at that component by itself on its own test rig, you can increase the temperature beyond the melting point of nylon bush if you are doing it in an informed way. So I think it's a very interesting question, and there are scenarios where the destruct limit might not apply, but I do take your point. Essentially, I think what you're trying to say is that you have to increase the temperature up to the point where it doesn't melt. If it goes beyond, if you melt something, then you're not doing a test at all. You're just melting something for the fun of it. When it, operating limits a little bit more finicky, because the operating limits tend to be how components interact. And again, it's very easy to have components, sorry, it's very common to have components where the steel alloys in particular, they're the last things that melt, so to speak. So yes and no, but I do take your point. I see where you're going with this. The nylon itself, if you're trying to do accelerated life testing on the nylon bush, which is the first thing that melts, well, of course, you cannot have an accelerated life test that goes beyond the melting point of nylon. So hopefully that answers your question. But I can see where you're going with it, and I think you're on the right track. There are scenarios where it's not technically relevant, but by the same token, I think what you're trying to say is if it melts, it's no longer a test. It's just an observation. No, we didn't discuss HALT too much. I have a HALT webinar if you're interested in understanding HALT or looking at HALT in a better way or different way. So this is all about accelerated life testing. And of course, if you want to contrast the two, please look at my HALT webinar. Not a problem, mate. Any more questions? Okay, Kevin writes, it is very important to know the basis of the failure mechanism, yes, physics of failure, concur, when designing an ALT test plan. For example, we accelerate stress slash strain in the HFC regime using Palgrin-Meier's damage rule and need to be careful to not have test loads that go outside HCF regime, like going into low cycle. Good point. The other thing other issue I'll raise is anything which is called a rule is not a model. What do I mean by that? A rule is something which we have observed and have not been able to be proven to be true. So Meiner's rule, for example, that C value, it can often be anywhere from 0.8 or 80% to 200, 220% sometimes. So it's a really useful, if you've validated the rule for your system, that's fine. Fantastic. But you, like you say, you don't want to ever go into low cycle regimes. Now, for example, what does low cycle mean? Let's just say this is a steel strut, and we know that steel is susceptible to fatigue, and you could potentially have lots of millions of cycles of this, and cause fatigue to occur in this it's not a metal a steel strut, but just for the sake of argument, let's just say it is. Now, if you increase the stresses so much, you move from what's called high cycle fatigue to low cycle fatigue. And low cycle fatigue is actually very different to high cycle fatigue. For those who have seen the SN curves, where you have those beautiful straight lines before you hit the endurance, or straight lines and hit the endurance limit, that's in the semi-log space. That's a very well-known shape that you see in steel alloy fatigue. Except when the stress is very, very high, i.e. the number of cycles to failure very, very low, in which case that straight line isn't straight anymore. It actually sort of curves and goes to the roof. So I believe, Keith, what you're saying is you want to increase the stress a lot to reduce the test duration, but you don't want to increase the stress so much that you move from high cycle fatigue through to low cycle fatigue, where the curve essentially, or the failure mechanism, is so different, you can't create that straight line. Is that what you're talking about, Keith? Yes. One of my first, when I was a young university student, my first exposure to high cycle fatigue versus low cycle fatigue was an accelerated life testing project involving a paperclip. And the idea was we're trying to see how long it would take for our paperclip to fail due to fatigue, where it was open and shut 45 degrees every single time. Now, when you went, and one way of increasing the stress was instead of opening and shutting at 45 degrees every single time, you open and shut it to 90 degrees and 135 degrees and 180 degrees, so on and so forth. And we're able to show that essentially when you open at 180 degrees and pushed it back again, the stress was so high, it started becoming low cycle fatigue. So we had to throw that test data away when it came to accelerated live testing. So hopefully that expounds on the question you asked, Kevin. Any more questions? I think I've exhausted them, Fred. I think.
All right, looks good.
All right, team. Hey, thank you very much for joining us again this month. I'll see you guys next month. I always say I need to do this, but I never seem to pull it off. I should research what my next webinar topic is, but I've forgotten again. But whatever it is, come July, I'll see those true believers then. And thank you very much for your time. Also, thank you very much for those really good questions. They were good questions. And yeah, hopefully you now have a new appreciation of what accelerated live testing is. And it's not just temperature. It can be voltage. It can be stress. It can be whatever it is that your thing, how, whatever, based on the failure mechanism of your thing. But hopefully you are now that much more confident, especially doing chemical reaction stuff with the Arrhenius plots.